Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Layton, working behind the scenes. Coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by Badcock Home Furniture's VP of Retail Operations, Mitchell Stiles. Mitchell will discuss not only the history behind Badcock, and they have kind of an interesting story, so I think that's very much worth listening to, but also their business operations and the way things are looking for them heading into the middle portion of 2021 with more velocity and more people buying home furnishings. And he'll talk also about things like supply chain challenges and their dealership model as well. In news, we'll discuss Kroger's recent earnings call, and we'll look ahead to seasonal sales for the July 4th holiday. The obligatory early show reminder that you can like us and rate us, whichever podcast listening service you happen to use. Your likes, your ratings, if positive, of course, help others to find us and check out the show. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram, where Layton uploads various news items that we find interesting, along with various pictures from our retail travels. Let's get right into it. As far as the news is concerned this week, Kroger released earnings, and we expected somewhat of a downturn in sales from 2020, as we've discussed with most grocery retailers, given the pandemic conditions and the panic buying conditions that marked the early portion of 2020. But we also expected an uptick overall from 2019, and those two things are exactly what we got from Kroger. And although Kroger's comps weren't as positive as some smaller grocery chains, as we discussed during Spartan Nash's earnings call a few weeks back, especially as far as those independents are concerned, the results were still enough for the headline on Kroger's release to read, "Kroger delivers strong first quarter results," and strong was a word that they used often during the actual audio portion of the call, and indeed the company felt that the results were strong enough that they increased guidance for the rest of fiscal 2021. That's a decent sign for the retailer, even if they didn't necessarily wow for the quarter, even if the numbers were just quietly strong, if you will. And let's start with those comps numbers. Without fuel, identical sales decreased 4.1% from 2020 for them. Again, this was lapping the early days of pandemic buying from 2020 and a portion of non-pandemic buying from 2020. On a two-year stack, though, and this is what most retailers are interested in, what most retailers have been talking about, comparisons to 2019 here, their identical sales increased 14.9%, which is, of course, a substantial jump for a retailer as large as Kroger. Digital sales, too, saw some slowing in terms of growth, although it was still up in comparison to overall comps and hopped up 16% from a year ago. Digital sales were up 108% for Kroger in the first quarter on a two-year stack basis. Now, if you look at overall company sales, it certainly doesn't look like much of a decrease. $41.5 billion last year, $41.3 billion this year. However, it's fuel sales and the rising cost of fuel along with increased demand that are mostly to credit here. Without fuel, revenue decreased 4% right around comp decreases. Additionally, Kroger's gross margin took a hit by 65 basis points. Among the culprits that were mentioned on the call were increased shrink, although analysts didn't ask about this, and Kroger really didn't go into depth on increased shrink and what that meant, whether it's in fresh goods, whether it's discounting product, whether it's throwing product away, what's happening there. But they also mentioned sales deleveraging, of course, from the pandemic. So they're selling less per store as a result of pandemic panic buying decreasing this year. As a result, rent costs are higher, operational costs are higher in comparison to sales. Also, they mentioned continued price investments, and that's something we haven't heard grocers talk a lot about over the past 15 months, and you have to wonder if we're going to dip back into the pre-pandemic price wars that we saw out there. However, Kroger did see record growth in alternative profits, including digital media. That's something we've discussed at length in the past as a focus area for Kroger, and this category helped to offset erosion of gross margin to an extent. As we mentioned in the beginning, the raw numbers this quarter prompted leadership to raise full-year guidance for Kroger, and now they expect comps to be in the negative 2.5 to 4% range for the full year, and that's a much better figure than they previously estimated. This works out to about a 10 to 11.5% increase on a two-year stack basis, and that's what Gary Millerchip, their CFO, kept referring to on the call as those two-year stack numbers. After being asked by an analyst on the call, by the way, CEO Rodney McMullen said that Q2 so far is tracking even better than the first quarter in terms of comps. We'll talk about some reasons why here in a moment. Millerchip, though, was quick to point out they do see some potential softening of the overall food at home spend as the year progresses, looking more towards the third and fourth quarters of this fiscal year. Still, Kroger feels as though their growth in share of food at home spend versus maybe other grocers, other retail outlets, maybe those food delivery services that you see out there, they feel as though that'll be enough to keep comps in a respectable neighborhood, even as you go into Q3 and Q4 and people stop spending so much money on food at home. Earnings per share estimates for Kroger for the full fiscal year now fall between $2.95 to $3.10 per share on an adjusted basis. That's after coming in with a number of $1.19. This quarter, analysts expected 99 cents, so a 20 cent beat there compared to Zach's consensus estimates. Now, we've gotten the numbers out of the way. As far as the more interesting stuff, let's talk about their initiatives and what they're seeing in store, also what they're seeing from some of their shopper data. First, as far as Kroger initiatives are concerned, they continued to scale up their private label offerings with increased velocity. They released 253 new items during the quarter. Many of these items happened to align with fresh, and fresh was probably the most mentioned word on the earnings call after strong, especially seasonal fresh produce categories and other seasonal specific verticals. And Kroger said they wanted to hit the summer cooking season hard, try to capitalize on some of these seasonal effects as people gathering more in backyards and the like, gathering potentially for July 4th celebrations as well. Now, something they reiterated on the call was their expanding partnership with 80 Acres Farms. And I think this is interesting and something to note for the retail food industry, for the grocery industry, especially as it pertains to produce. 80 Acres Farms is a vertical indoor farming company. So basically, these vertical indoor farming companies work a little bit differently, but what it looks like for them is basically you've got a warehouse space, it's several stories tall, and they're growing things like lettuce, for example, on these large racks. The lettuce gets rotated to see light differently, and they've got number of lights inside, of course. And what this means is you're able to grow the produce, of course, year-round, regardless of temperature, because you're in somewhat of a temperature-controlled facility. Now, the partnership that Kroger had with 80 Acre Farms previously just stretched throughout Ohio, but they mentioned they're now expanding it to over 300 stores. This was first announced in March, but it was reiterated on the call. Most of the 300 stores, of course, in the Midwest and upper Midwest. And Kroger feels as though the benefit from this partnership, it's not just mentioning, oh, hey, we're partnering with this company that sells a lot of organic food, that sells a lot of locally created produce. It's not only the ready availability of this, what I call non-tree produce year-round. Basically, again, you're looking at a lot of greens as an example there, but also the fact that 80 Acres Farms model allows for lower shipping distance and time, which means greater shelf life and, in theory, lower shrink for Kroger. If you look at it from Kroger's perspective, 80 Acres Farms has, let's say, three warehouses in the Cincinnati area. I say, let's say they do have three warehouses that grow food in the Cincinnati area. Of course, Cincinnati right in Kroger's wheelhouse. So those stores, of course, are going to benefit from sourcing lettuce and greens, things that easily spoil from 80 Acres Farms in those areas versus maybe sourcing those same products from Mexico, California, or Texas. So again, lower shipping distance and time. Of course, carbon footprint gets mentioned in the press releases, but at least as far as the bottom line is concerned for Kroger, you're throwing less of it out because it stays fresher longer, again, in theory. And as 80 Acres Farms expands to other warehouses throughout the upper Midwest, Kroger similarly seems to expect this partnership to expand. Now, as an extension of this, Kroger announced a supplier accelerator in the quarter. What this does is this allows local suppliers an easier pathway into Kroger stores. If you talk to anyone in the supplier field, anyone especially in the produce field, they will tell you it can be difficult to break into stores for one reason or another. And Whole Foods has always been kind of the go-to for these outlets and operations, but we've seen Whole Foods since the Amazon purchase. They still source food locally, of course, no doubt about that, but it is more difficult for local suppliers to get into Whole Foods, especially since the Amazon purchase, especially since they're keeping an eye on margins. So far, though, Kroger, since launching this accelerator program, they've received over 1,000 applications from potential suppliers. So once again, a good thing for Kroger in that, in theory, you're sourcing things fresher if you're getting them from local suppliers throughout the country for your various brands. And again, it's a win for these suppliers as well, able to kind of crack that nut in terms of getting into a large grocery store chain. One other focus for Kroger has obviously been digital. We talked about digital sales being up year over year 16%. They continued to work on this front during the quarter. They ended the quarter with 98% of Kroger households covered by pickup and delivery. Some of their smaller legacy locations, especially in the rural plains, have yet to adopt it, but for the most part, it's now universal. They work to reallocate staffing as well in order to accommodate a 15% increased pickup capacity for them. And this resulted in more time slots being added around high volume times during the course of the quarter. Also, credit to their associates too, because their picking time also shrank by 5%. Associates becoming more efficient with this, what's relatively a new job in the retail industry. Now, not completely new, because you could argue that, say, Sam's Club has had a program like this, even via fax, for a long period in time. But as far as grocery is concerned, certainly in the history of grocery, this is a relatively newer role. Associates are becoming more used to it, more efficient at it, and this too is helping Kroger to open up more slots for their customers. So again, credit to those associates there. Some general notes regarding grocery and grocery sales overall from Rodney McMullen on the call. I think a lot of this is interesting. Now, some of it is going to be kind of, self-fulfilling, because they're using Kroger data for some of these findings. But using Kroger customer data, 92% of people say they enjoy cooking the same or more than pre-COVID. And of course, that bodes well for improved sales or continued improved sales versus 2019. But one caveat to that number, that's not a general population number. Again, you're just looking at Kroger customers. So they're going to the grocery store to buy food, to prepare at home. Of course, they're not as likely to maybe eat out as non-Kroger customers might. Now, this has parlayed itself into continued strength for Kroger in terms of base food categories, especially meat, produce, and natural foods, all of which have been strong categories, not only throughout the pandemic, but also in the most recent quarter. And this is versus prepackaged or pre-prepared foods, which is also something that you saw fly off the shelves in Q1 of last year. So meat, produce, natural foods, not only something that Kroger hitting in ad campaigns, but also they're seeing a lot of sales regarding those categories because of all the people preparing food at home. Additionally, they've seen customers increasingly trading up to premium products. Now, this is something that industry analysts have been split on. Basically, the argument between value versus premium as 2021 moves forward. And indeed, earlier this year, we had two guests on the show that each had different takes on this based on their own data. So it depends on what data set you're looking at. At least as far as Kroger is concerned, they are seeing this trading up phenomenon as 2021 extends. Will it continue once the stimulus money kind of tails off? That remains to be seen. They feel pretty confident in it continuing, however leadership does. What Kroger has specifically seen is trading up within private labels. So for example, customers may be eschewing the traditional Kroger brand for Private Selection and Simple Truth, which are their elevated and organic store brands respectively, and something that they feel very confident in. Speaking of which, they said store brands actually performing pretty well in terms of overall share. Analyst asks on the call, is that, hey, Nielsen data suggests private label product sales might be going down as a share of overall grocery sales. Kroger said, hey, that is not the case. Both McMullen and Millerchip on the call said, hey, our private label sales looking very good. Thank you very much. And there's a lot of trading up there, which is in turn increasing their margin. Now, additionally, 50% of Kroger customers say their holiday shopping and gathering habits will return to normal by the July 4th holiday, which is important because we might see sales expand throughout the grocery industry for those July 4th cookouts that are maybe happening this year, the larger gatherings maybe happening this year that didn't have a chance to happen last year. Because of customers' focus on fresh goods, and also, as I mentioned, their marketing push towards fresh, the whole fresh for everyone tagline for all of their brands, they continue to attempt to grade out stores based on produce quality and appearance, based on fresh quality and appearance for meats as well. So that's something that they've got internal metrics on. They say their internal metrics are improving on that front. And of course, those partnerships that we mentioned with various local suppliers can only help those initiatives. And although they didn't mention it during the prepared remarks, they were asked about inflation during the Q&A. And they had a more nuanced take than what we've heard from some grocers. Basically, the Cliff's Notes version of it was that Kroger operates best under 3 to 4% inflation rates in terms of profitability, in terms of revenue generation. However, right now, at least in the first quarter, they saw rates come in the 1 to 2% range, which was a little bit lower than what some might have been indicating. And they noted that inflation in this last quarter was largely driven by the volatility in the pricing of fresh goods in the quarter. So the categories that are doing best for them, they're seeing a lot of volatility there. Moreover, supply chain volatility and costs for those fresh goods. As a company, though, and this is a very interesting, and this is where I said that take got a little nuanced from Kroger, they feel as though they're in a position to benefit from a potential inflationary environment if it is driven primarily by supply chain costs rather than the costs of the raw materials themselves. Here's why. Because their private label brands are vertically integrated. They're not using a third party for these private label brands. They can control costs somewhat on that front. They have warehouses that are dedicated specifically to the manufacture, production, and distribution of these goods. That means that the private label brands should be available to customers at a roughly stable price as long as you're not looking at raw materials costs increasing. Difference there is national brands might have to increase pricing and MSRPs because of the additional delivery step in that process. Of course, that delivery step touching that supply chain volatility, those increased shipping costs that we've been talking about recently. This has the eventual effect, Kroger feels as though it does anyway, of driving customers to private labels, and that in turn could give Kroger higher margins. So if inflation were to pick up even above the 3 to 4% range, as long as it's not raw materials inflation and it's shipping related or supply chain related, Kroger feels really good about where they're positioned with that, because every time that happens, every time costs bump up for, say, a national producer, let's say Frito-Lay, for example, people might go down the chip aisle and choose that private selection offering or choose the Kroger branded offering because the prices there are relatively stable. And you see the cleft between those prices, between the national brands and the private label brands, even the premium private label brands, grow larger. So just something to kind of keep in mind there. And I think that's important to note for others that control their own private label processes as well. So obviously you're looking at the big operators there, Albertsons and Walmart too. Well, that'll do it for our news story for this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Coming up after this, we'll be joined by Mitchell Stiles, Badcock's VP of Retail Operations. He'll be discussing not only Badcock Home Furnishings operations, but also a little bit about their history and a little bit about the challenges they've faced over the last couple of years with the pandemic and with increased demand for furniture and home goods. Regular listeners know that we enjoy discussing what are sometimes termed as legacy retailers. One such retailer is a staple of home furnishings retail in the U.S., particularly in the Southeast, and that is Badcock Home Furnishings. We're pleased to be joined today by Badcock's VP of Retail Operations, Mitchell Stiles, who is here to discuss not only Badcock's history, but also some new initiatives at the retailer as we head into the middle of 2021. By the way, he's been with the company since 2000 as well. Mitchell, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here. It's an honor.
First, for our listeners that might not be familiar with Badcock, I was wondering if you could discuss a bit about the history of the company. I know it's very much a family-based company, and then also where Badcock kind of stands today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm actually a fifth-generation descendant of the founder. So my great-great-grandfather founded the business in 1904, but you know, his story goes back long before that. He actually was an immigrant from England. He came into the United States. He actually boarded a ship called the Egypt, and he came over into the New York harbor seeking opportunity. And he felt like, you know, New York was a little dirty for him, and he thought opportunity would be better somewhere else in the country. And so he boarded the Seminole, and he went down to Tallahassee, Florida, and he met a couple who were on the Seminole that were heading to the big town of Mulberry, Florida, which was booming with phosphate. Now, I have to be very honest with you and tell you that, you know, we have like three working traffic lights today. So we're not so much of a big town now, but a lot of great people here. And so when he came here, he met his wife and he went to work in a general store as the manager of that general store for a number of years. And then his wife's mother passed away and they sold her property in Alabama for $800. And he took that $800 and he parlayed it into his own store. So that's when we were founded, but obviously a lot of history building up to that. Now, today, we have 382 locations in 8 southern states. 313 of them are owned by independent businessmen and women that we refer to as dealers. It is not a franchise platform. It's a dealership. And so that is kind of a high-level view of who we are and how far we've come. So 117 years, long time.
The reason I ask this is because I know just from feedback from listeners and the like, they love retail history as a whole. So I'm wondering, in terms of kind of bridging that gap over the last, 120 years or so, just an estimate there, how did the company evolve and grow to include, as you mentioned, kind of the dealer platform, as you mentioned, the expansion of stores? What did, you know, say the 1900s look like throughout that century as the company continued to grow and evolve?
Well, I will say that, you know, at its most fundamental roots, he founded the business under the slogan that, you know, Badcock will treat you right. And so that slogan is embedded in our DNA. And even today, you know, we always start with what is right, you know, no matter what the problem at hand is. And that often sometimes means that the financial piece is second to what the solution should be in terms of what is right. He took the business right up into the Great Depression. And then his son, my great-grandfather, was involved at that point. And what they did in that time really kind of set the foundation for this dealer model. So he had route men that he called them route men that he would send out to collect $1 or $2 from, say, you know, Mrs. Stiles. And they started coming back and telling him that, you know, Mrs. Stiles was asking for a sofa or a table. And so he started to give that merchandise to that route man on consignment. And then he paid them a percent of what they collected. And so once those route men started having more demand in some of the outer lying areas of Mulberry, you know, one of them decided to open up a store. And so he had to trust that person early on to carry on what he was doing in Mulberry. And so he just grew the business just one relationship at a time. Any retailer, you think about like different verticals and different industries that create things, right? They create something. So what does a retailer create if they're just selling product? And so one of the things that we like to believe is that we create opportunity. And it's kind of hokey to say that, but not just in the form of, you know, if you want to have a career here and you work hard and your efforts get recognized, not just that opportunity, but we create the opportunity for people to own their own business. And that is something that, you know, we're very proud of. That's the dealership model. And so I think that one thing that is very important for us is to just recognize what we have in our hands. And this is the American dream, so to speak. And so you got a lot of our owners, a lot of our dealers, you know, they started out as delivery men. They started out as sales associates, and they've worked hard and they've been recognized. And then they had the opportunity to buy into their own store. And I think that that is something that really is unique. And a lot of people may not know that about us. And so important to recognize that, you know, the relationship piece is so important to any business. But for us, you know, we serve two sets of customers. We serve that dealer, you know, that is serving the end user that is buying the furniture. And then we also serve the end user as well. And so I think what has allowed us to be successful and what has really been the secret sauce for us is our dealership network. They live and breathe in these communities. They're local. It's not, you know, they have a vested interest in it. And I think that's been something that has really, really been beneficial for us. And, you know, obviously that comes with challenges, right? You know, we 313 of the stores are dealer stores and the rest are corporate owned. And so in management, you have two different hats you have to wear. You know, on the corporate side of the business, you know, it's more of a teller mentality. And that's, you know, we have sellers and tellers. I mean, we don't take that approach, but that's the easiest way to explain it. I walk into a corporate store and we say, here's the recipe. Here's how it works. This is what we do. Well, you walk into a dealer store and they own that business. And so you have to sell them on an idea. You can't just make quick, rapid change. And so in some ways, it has kept us conservative because of that, but it has really served as a nice blanket of insulation for the organization.
So that gives us a little bit of a background surrounding the retail model, surrounding the genesis, if you will, of Badcock. Now, I want to hop in the DeLorean, come back to 2021 here. As customer tastes shift and the way in which customers are making home furnishing selections has also shifted, what are some changes that the company has made to kind of facilitate that long-term health of Badcock, not only for those corporate-owned stores, but as you mentioned, those dealer stores as well?
So, yeah, that's a good question. I think that on our most fundamental level, you know, we're a retailer that sells furniture, appliances, electronics, mattresses, but, you know, we also have this vertical within our business of ownership, becoming a dealer and owning your own business. And I think that the biggest thing that we have done over the last 50 years, I would say, just to pick a number, is that we changed the compensation of the dealer network. And we started paying them on what they sell, and we centralized the collection efforts. So I guess I should back up and tell you that, you know, in addition to us being a furniture retailer, we're also a finance company that sells furniture. So we hold our own paper. We do not farm it out to a bank. You know, we're on the hook for it. We're making loans every single day to consumers. And that is something that, you know, for a long time, the dealer was making those decisions at retail. And we made a change to that. And we centralized all of those efforts. And we started paying them on what they sold. Whereas in the old model, which we called the receipt-based model, we paid them a percentage of what they collected. And so that has been a monumental change. And from it, the focus at retail has really changed. And so the last few years have been an incredible run of growth for us. We've opened up over 30 new dealer stores. And we also sold, you know, over 70 of our corporate stores to new incoming dealers as well. So I think that's probably been the biggest change in advance that we've made to make sure that our health is going to be secure in the future. It really kind of showed itself in the pandemic too, that you had these local business owners that were there, you know, really working their business and fighting to make sure that they were able to continue to serve those customers and meet those customers' needs during that time. And you kind of wonder what it would be like if it was on the old model. So I think that's been a very, very positive change for us moving forward.
And you mentioned it with that answer. Obviously, customer financing, such a big topic in home furnishings retail. Outside of kind of adjusting your model, as you mentioned, where it's no longer that receipt model, what are some other maybe recent developments and advances that you've implemented in terms of facilitating that customer financing there?
Well, I think that, you know, we've made a shift to get more digital in this process. You know, it's so easy to apply for credit online, you know, and I think 25 years ago, getting credit as a customer was not nearly as easy as it is today, right? And so that was always a competitive advantage for us. And so I think understanding that, you know, consumers do not want to come into any location and have to fill out a bunch of paperwork, right? You want to make that process as easy and as seamless as possible. And so, you know, one of the things that we're doing, and this is something that's in constant approach, is getting that process in the customer's hand. And so, you know, this is getting the customer to apply for that credit on their phone with just a couple of buttons to push, where the credit decision is much more intimate and much more private to the consumer. You know, nobody wants to be told no, right? And so a lot of people will be hesitant to try and apply for credit in all different verticals. But really getting it in the consumer's hand is something that we have really strived to do. And I think that that's going to be something that really benefits us long term. I believe that, you know, what we're seeing is that the easeability of applying for credit goes up, you know, when you make it such that they can do it right there on their phone. So that's going to be something that we continue to try and sharpen and hone and just make as easy as possible. Verify identity and let's go buy some furniture.
Well, speaking of buying that furniture, I know that Badcock has released a number of new product lines, especially over the last few years. And I was wondering if we took a step maybe away from the financing aspect, if you could give us a bit of a macro level view in terms of what that process looks like for you when new product lines are launched, from both the conception of that product line to inclusion in the stores and ensuring that dealers have everything that they need to make sure they're marketing it properly.
Yeah, so, you know, I would say a few things here. You know, we have a buying team, just an incredible group of guys and girls that are constantly working on new builds within the merchandising space. And we're able to buy year round and develop product year round, which allows us to be very nimble in that aspect. And there's two furniture markets in High Point, North Carolina, one in April, one in October. Now, COVID disrupted that. We actually were at market last week. And then you have two markets out in Las Vegas as well. But us being able to work directly with manufacturers and with our supplier partners allows us to be, I wouldn't say on the cutting edge, but it allows us to just be more, as I said earlier, a little more nimble in that regard. But one of the things that we do is we involve retail in the process. So they drag me around at market and some other folks we have from retail. And that allows a little bit of a voice from the retail side of the business. But, you know, where the rubber meets the road is in the stores. And so we just recently launched a new product line that we called the Stanhope. It's better quality goods. Our founder, Henry Stanhope Badcock, the Stanhope line has been very well received in the stores. And when, you know, we have an annual show that we have with our dealers. And then we also have, you know, monthly calls with our dealers. We have two in-person meetings outside of that annual show with our dealers as well. In fact, I'm leaving tomorrow to head up to North Carolina, where we will start that road show that will last about 10 days. And, you know, when we launched the Stanhope, we did it for a number of reasons, right? But one of the feedbacks that we got from the stores is that, you know, we could sell higher priced, better quality goods, you know, quality, quality, quality. And so by listening to our business partners, the dealers, we were able to make a major merchandising shift and initiative to launch this product. And so they were bought in from the start. And then when we roll it out at retail, that's something that has changed that I have seen in this space is that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, let's say, you had a lot of vendors that were involved in the stores training and developing. And you don't see that as much now. And you certainly don't see it when we go direct to a manufacturer and we are building something our own. So it's on us to make sure that the associates in the stores understand the features and benefits of that product. And so little snackable videos that we push out. And this is an initiative too that we're still working on, but we want those videos to be uploaded onto our website as well, so consumers can see them, very easy to digest. So we really just want to try and involve the stores and retail as possible But we also have to guard against and just recognize the fact that I, you know, Mitchell Stiles, I am not a buyer by any means. And so, you know, respecting those buyers' decisions and their expertise for what they are and just merely giving them an opinion here and there when asked. But we have a really good team and a good process in place for product.
So before we hopped on here, started recording, you mentioned you've spent the last few weeks, obviously you travel a lot, but you've seen some ribbon cuttings. You've seen, during your time at Badcock, certainly expansion, as we've discussed. As you look back at the last 10 years or so, what is maybe the thing that you're proudest of, or maybe a couple of things you're proudest of Badcock accomplishing as a company?
I think that, you know, transitioning the business from the receipt-based model to what we call the sales-based model would be and will be one of the largest accomplishments that we've had here as an organization. I mean, just the blunt change of that was tremendous to the organization, and it wasn't easy, right? I mean, we changed a tire going 80 miles an hour down the road. And so all of the work and the effort that went into that with our partners and internal associates that were on that team, yeah, I think that's the biggest accomplishment that we've had as a company. Now, that said, you know, also weathering this pandemic, you know, we happen to be open long enough that, you know, we've been through two pandemics as an organization, and there's certainly, there's no playbook laying around on how you navigate through it. And we've seen a lot of businesses and a lot of industries be affected by this differently than we have. You know, there's been a big demand in the home, and that can serve as a benefit to us. And it's just been very hard to navigate through that. But getting through it, you know, as we sit here right now, we have over 90,000 pieces on back order. Supply chain disruption, you know, everything from the storm in Texas to the Suez Canal, raw material increases. Just being able to navigate through that is an incredible accomplishment. And, you know, as I sit here and talk to you now, and as I'm talking, I will have to say that probably navigating through the pandemic is our biggest accomplishment. Because how I remember how I felt 15 months ago, and I think we all had that moment where, you know, we all kind of held onto the railing and wondered what it was going to look like. And now, having gone through the last 15 months, I'd say that's probably the best accomplishment we've had.
It's something you mentioned there. It's not simply as easy as saying, oh, well, there's been an increase in demand for home-based products because people are at home more often. As we've heard time and again in the media, there's a lot of impacts behind the scenes. So what are some of the things that you've done to kind of mitigate, whether they be supply chain shortages or raw materials increases and the like, as you've navigated the last 15 months?
Well, I mean, communication is key in everything, right? And, you know, I think as humans, we all think that we're good communicators, but that's probably the thing that we could all work on the most. And so I think communication with our suppliers, communication with our customers, communication with our dealers is key. And understanding that this is not going to just stop overnight. The labor market right now is very tough. And I think just being transparent about what we're dealing with. You know, we started talking about disruption in supply chain in April of last year, you know, to be ready for it. Now, at that point in time, you know, we were just thinking that the supply chain was going to be disrupted because factories were going to be shutting down because of COVID. And it has stretched on a lot longer. Freight forwarders have reduced capacity on ships. There's a global shortage of containers. Domestically, you have a huge demand for drivers. As I mentioned, you know, the storm in Texas, you know, shutting down some foam producers, you know, on top of it, this mass amount of stimulus money being released into the market. And so it's been a daily battle, honestly. And, you know, I think communication is just the key to getting through it, you know, working together with both our supplier partners and our dealer stores and our corporate stores.
Some great insight there. And one thing I want to wrap up on, of course, we don't want you giving away any company secrets or anything like that, but what's next on the horizon for Badcock? What do the next couple of years hold for you?
You know, I would say growth, not to give up too much, but growth is very, very important for us. And we have a lot of initiatives. I shouldn't say a lot. We have a couple of initiatives that are going to really kind of continue that fire there. And I think that it's important for us to recognize that this is an emotional business. It's a very personal purchase. So we need to make it personal. You know, we're not just selling sofas. Think about the news that's going to be delivered on that sofa, you know, families watching movies, conversation at the dinner table. There's just a lot of personal aspects to what we do. And the most sacred place is a home. And so we have to keep that in the forefront of our thought process and our approach to the consumer. And so we are going to be getting a lot more personal in our message to the consumer. So that would be my two little secrets there, if those count.
I think those are secrets enough. Well, Mitchell, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. It's been a fantastic conversation, and I know our listeners have enjoyed a lot of hearing about not only the past, but also the present there at Badcock.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me on.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Mitchell for joining us. It's an engaging individual, to be sure. And again, a longtime family-run business. He's a member of that family. But you could really tell, and I could tell just talking to him off of the air, how much he cares about the company, how much he cares about the organization. And it's something where, you know, we don't really talk about them a whole lot on the show because they are a private company. But again, over 380 locations in the southeastern United States, many of those dealer-based locations, and they continue to see success as they move into the last half of 2021. Well, it's time to look ahead at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And just as we do nearly every time during this time of year, but especially the last couple of years, I'm looking ahead at fireworks sales surrounding July 4th. Fireworks and this type of seasonal retail can often be overlooked, just like Halloween sales or those pop-up Halloween shops sales can be overlooked during the fall. But last year was a banner year for fireworks companies, as a lot of cities, municipalities, groups canceled their larger fireworks shows because of the pandemic, and that forced people into basically putting on their own backyard fireworks shows, if you will. Now, the question this year is not necessarily about increasing sales. One would think that sales to consumers, not necessarily sales to cities and municipalities, for example, would decrease, but mainly about supply chain, something we've talked a lot about. Of course, with so many of these fireworks coming from specifically China, shipping has been slow on these. So this has forced domestic fireworks operators, according to not only those in the industry that I've talked directly with, but also various articles that are out there, to kind of ramp up supply throughout the first half of the year, knowing that supply chain would likely be an issue as they got into summer. As a result, fireworks stands are asking people to shop a little earlier this year, so we'll see if stock might be an issue for various fireworks stands. And of course, there's always the issue of Mother Nature agreeing or disagreeing with you. Now, where I'm at in Colorado, we've seen an unseasonably rainy June. I think it would be fair to say, at least my residence has gotten about 3 inches in the last couple of days, where we might get 3 inches for an entire month most Junes. But in other areas of the country, certainly it's been dry. You have record heat going on in the northwestern United States, so you certainly wonder how that's going to affect sales in terms of local fireworks regulations. You also have certain areas and states, for example, Ohio, allowing additional fireworks and additional types of fireworks to be sold. So there's a lot of other impacts that go on beyond just the household demand for fireworks. But I am interested to see exactly how demand for fireworks shakes out over the next week as we approach the July 4th holiday. Again, more people having the larger family gatherings. Maybe they decided last year those home fireworks shows were fun and they'll just invite more people over to do it. Maybe we'll see sales tail off, at least to the general public this year, and you'll see more of the wholesale sales to the larger cities and, again, larger fireworks shows companies maybe going up. So anxious to see how that'll work. And like I said, I've got a few connections in that industry, so might be a story we'll follow up on, if notable, over the next couple of weeks on the podcast. Well, once again, we thank Leighton behind the scenes from Mitchell Styles as well from Badcock for joining us, and we'll see you once again approximately 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.